pharma, it's a great industry now that's accelerating very quickly into digital use. Obviously, when you lose key channels to your customers, you need to quickly adapt, and they've done a fabulous job at that. I'm incredibly impressed by the work that's been done in the last year in terms of moving to digital.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
The topic today is: the world has become digital first. What will it take for pharma to catch up? And I have two panelists today representing different sides of the healthcare spectrum. So Dr. Rutt will be focusing on the back-end safety, the business side, and the regulatory insights, whereas Dr. Reeves will be focused on the front-end, the customer, and the physician and the patient. So I'll just introduce my panelists. So I've got Dr. Andrew Rutt, who is the founder and CEO of My Meds and Me. He's a trained physician, and he specialized in endocrinology and genetics. He has held multiple roles in drug discovery and development in GSK, in Europe, America, and APAC. He was previously head of safety at GSK, where he drove significant innovation and streamlining into the organization. So welcome, Dr. Rutt. And I've also got Dr. John Reeves, who is the CEO and founder of Conversation Health. He is also a physician and a serial entrepreneur. Dr. John has been disrupting healthcare since he went into clinical practice in 1994. He's constantly looking for new technology applications to resolve key clinical challenges, and he firmly believes that physicians should lead the disruption of healthcare. He has over 20 years in digital, leading innovation at large organizations as well as startups, including Conversational Health. Welcome, Dr. Reeves.
Welcome. Pleasure.
So, with what happened last year, it's been said that the digital transformation has really leapt forward by 10 years in 1 year, with consumers first forced and then choosing to go digital first with both their personal and their commercial activities. So consumers, patients, and physicians are expecting to source medical information, but also to report side effects, product issues, and other things through digital means. So we're going to start this panel by looking at how can technology help address the needs of pharma? And I thought I might just start with Dr. Rutt, because we've done a webinar on what happened with the vaccinations and the adverse event reporting. So why don't we just start with that perspective first, and then we'll move on to Dr. John's perspective.
Yeah, sure, Andre. I mean, I think as we said in the previous webinar, for me, it's all about data. And, you know, I think Dr. John and I will probably resonate on that point, is whether you're in trials or whether you're in the post-approval phase, you need data. And what we've seen during the pandemic is getting robust data, whether it's on the COVID products or other products, has been challenging. And where companies have had the data, and I would point to those companies who've been really transparent about their data, they've stood above the crowd, and their products have, you know, their vaccines have actually been, call it, trusted and well received. Where there's been any sniff, whether it's real or unreal, of data not being completely open and not being collected in the way that the protocol might have defined, people have questioned that. So I think for me, you know, we've moved from a world maybe 5 years ago where trials were perhaps much more paper-based. We're moving to a world of much more accelerated trials. But then that puts pressure, and maybe this is what we'll cover, that puts huge pressure on the market authorization holder at the time of authorization. Because those commitments then of to fill the blanks in terms of the efficacy and particularly the safety profile at the time of launch are huge. So we've got actually a very narrow boundary of knowledge at the time of launch, and that boundary of knowledge has to be filled very quickly in the post-approval phase. And we can call that real-world data or whatever else, but if it's not filled appropriately and the data is not collected appropriately, actually we've got a real problem. And I think that's where I think the digital first part will come to the fore, because we can access robust data across large numbers of people very quickly and actually make assessments of how those products work across a much more general population that we had in trials. And maybe sort of, you know, I was thinking about this webinar, and I'll hand over to Dr. John after this, is thinking about the digital first part. So yes, I think most patients and most consumers now expect their healthcare to be digital first, whether that's in trials or in the post-approval setting. And I think we all believe that they want to access that their healthcare or information, you know, 24/7, 365, in an accurate and trusted way. The second part, I would say, is physical fast. And this is the piece that I really pisses me off at the moment. And I'll say, as a physician, it's very difficult for a patient to have a rectal examination virtually. So I think the first part is, let's play digital where it should play, which is providing access to healthcare information two ways in for patients live, you know, essentially in a digital space, while enabling the physical care, whether as part of a trial or real world study or real healthcare, to occur as it should do, and make that, you know, focus physicians and healthcare professionals on the pieces they should be doing. And I think that's where the digital world can help them. So I'll stop.
Well, just to follow up on that. So with technology for adverse event reporting, what kind of things can technology do in that space?
I think, firstly, it brings the reporting to the patient. I think that's the first part. So I think if we're taking a clinical trial scenario, if we take COVID or even the accelerated programs for oncology products, what companies want is accurate data, a total picture of their product as accurately and as fast as possible from the patients, because ultimately the patient's experiencing the adverse event. And at the moment, you know, even today, typically, even in our, call it, decentralized trial model, patients typically provide their adverse event data at the time of a visit, whether that's a virtual visit or a real physical visit. And that's just nuts. And that data then has to be sifted through by a healthcare professional, reported to a pharma company within 24 hours. Patient may have experienced those issues a month before. So actually, there's two pieces. One, the data is inaccurate because recall is inaccurate. The second part is there's a lost opportunity to collect data that's time limited. Because most of us know that it's pretty difficult to recreate a set of blood results if the events occurred a month ago. So, you know, we've actually lost an opportunity to ask relevant questions, to collect relevant data around the time of the events occurring. And therefore, I think this is where, you know, conversation health come in, and therefore to actually communicate with the patient in a way that's meaningful to maximize their adherence, to minimize their adverse events, to minimize their risks, and potentially intervene in terms of reducing dose or taking them off the drug. So I think those are pieces within the clinical trial setting that can be done. In the real world setting, exactly the same applies, where actually, you know, currently we know that probably, I mean, if we're on a good day with a fair wind behind us, about 1 in 100 of the events that occur to patients are actually reported on most products, and it's probably 1 in 1,000 for older products. So we're losing data big time. So we have a tiny amount of the real data coming through, and I think digital tools can make it much easier and much more intuitive and much more rewarding for patients to provide that information in real time and get feedback about what's happening and information that helps them manage their disease and manage the products that they're on.
Interesting. And Dr. John, could you talk about how technology can address the needs of pharma from a customer-centric point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I'll also just connect back to that concept of digital first. So the other question is, you know, and this transformation has taken place because of COVID. I was just thinking a little bit earlier that, you know, we talk about it compressing 10 years of digital kind of evolution into a year. I don't actually know if without COVID, if we'd actually evolved to where we are now, because some of the transformations are just the fundamental transformation that we don't actually have to see physicians, you know, face to face for so much of what we do. I don't know if we actually would have overcome the friction of the way the system was set up had the pandemic not taken place. I think obviously that's driven massive thinking about, you know, the digital first experience. Our customers, consumers, patients, physicians have always, not always, for the past, you know, 10, 15 years, have been digital first. Right? We know that there's a billion searches on, you know, Google every day for healthcare information. Some of those searches are by physicians, right? They're looking for information. The question now was there going to be a transformation in pharma from moving away from the concept of the push model, the heavily vested into the human touch point, into more of the digital touch point? And I think what we've seen is that there is a new capability, a new capacity through the virtualization of healthcare to achieve many of those business objectives, but to do it in a way that our customers actually want. I think, I think probably Andrew, would agree that, the magical moments in healthcare typically in the past have been, that kind of face-to-face experience, something magical happens there. And I think that the opportunity we have now is to make sure that those kinds of experiences, these human-like experiences, and sometimes they will be AI powered, actually don't take place at that episodic moment, but are more at that moment of need. And so that's really about that fundamental transformation about going to a pull model than the push model, right? So digital is inherently an on-demand pull strategy, right? You need to be there, and you don't, customers don't come to our digital touch points to be marketed to. It's just not the way it works, right? It's more of a PR channel. You need to be there to answer their questions first. And so what we're seeing is that the experience is digital first, 24/7 on demand, all of these things. But I think what pharma's realizing is that if you can be there at that moment of need for a customer and answer their question, that they will give you then the opportunity to communicate more commercial messages that are contextual. I think this comes to reality when you start looking at COVID. What are the demands on one of the new, let's call them vaccine manufacturers, to respond to inbound conversations or information? It's overwhelming, right? And so one of the, the key projects we've been working on in Q1 is actually deploying a conversational experience that allows you to handle, millions of inbound queries or questions from consumers, patients, and physicians about products. Okay, so literally, we've gone to a transformation now where every brand, every pharma company has to realize that that is the starting point. And if digital is the starting point, it's a new way of interacting.
Yeah. Well, is the industry ready is the next question.
So let me build on a little bit on what John has said. I think the pharma industry is sort of trying to get ready. And I think we've got the privilege of working together across our two companies. And one of the outreach programs we're running is with organizations that are all pharma companies that have strong consumer healthcare portfolios. So very direct to patients, where people self-pay. So where people self-pay, they tend to be rather interested in what happens to them, and particularly where they self-pay for their medicines without a medical professional intervening. And, if I look at something like AbbVie's website, which, call it in the Zoom world, now focuses on a product you all know well, is Botox. They are really reaching out to consumers directly and using every marketing tool possible to market a product that's, a medicinal product, in a way that's very different to what we've seen in the traditional pharma world. But yet that product is a pharmaceutical product. And if you look at how it's administered, obviously people are now looking carefully at who they should choose to administer that product. It's no longer, just go down to any old clinic and find somebody to inject. And I think that's a key thing. And then you've got counterfeits, you've got maladministration. So there are all sorts of issues, but people want information about that product, want to know who's the trusted provider, want to know what doses they can get, how it can be used. And obviously it's used for other, more medical rather than aesthetic purposes as well. But I think that epitomizes what John was saying, is that 24/7 access, the pull where people are wanting that information all the time. Simultaneously, obviously, pharma then can provide, less subtle in that consumer world messaging, but in the medicines world, probably slightly more subtle marketing messages, or call it adherence messaging, that enables that patient to trust the brand and stay on that brand.
Yeah, interesting. And then when we're talking about digital first with pharma, what are you seeing? What do you think pharma are doing in the digital, how widespread is digital first across pharma?
Well, I mean, I'll speak from the conversational AI perspective. So first of all, I think, listen, pharma, it's a great industry now that's accelerating very quickly into digital use. Obviously, when you lose key channels to your customers, you need to quickly adapt, and they've done a fabulous job at that. I'm incredibly impressed by the work that's been done in the last year in terms of moving to digital. In our space, you know, I think one of the questions, and I was around for the first couple of horizons when it was web and when we went through the kind of the social and app horizons about how pharma came in and leveraged these new capabilities. I think one of the good things is that because we've been through a few digital horizons already, I think the way they approach new capabilities like conversational AI are far more strategic and measured, and that they're doing the appropriate kind of POCs. They're doing all the right things. And I am really encouraged by how quickly they're recognizing this as a new capability. The other thing I would say is that, you know, historically in the past, as we move into a new capability, we tend not to understand that capability and leverage it the way it should be used, right? We use more historical models of how to use it as a channel. I think one of the things that we're seeing very quickly is that pharma understands that a conversation is different than content, right? They're rooted in conversations. They have conversations that are taking place 24/7 through their human touch points. And then what they're realizing is that it's not just about a technical capability. It really is about a communication capacity and understanding how to best leverage this new channel to drive all of the things that Andrew was saying. It's for everything from awareness, right, to product start, to compliance. All of these things are critical components of a communication strategy. And so it's really not that different when one thinks about it from having a conversation with another human, right? It's all about understanding basic UX principles. And I think that just as in general, to sum it up, the industry has great digital capability. And I think that they're bringing that into this new horizon of conversational AI and actually using it in a very appropriate way.
Yeah, interesting. I did read something in Fierce Pharma recently that, and also with Accenture, there's this very interesting divide at the moment where physicians are very much into fully digital or fully face-to-face, but not into the hybrid where the rep is on a Zoom call with them. So that seems to be, there seems to be a lot of that, but the efficacy of the rep on the Zoom call has just gone very low, according to Fierce Pharma. And I saw Accenture was saying, I think something like 87% of doctors are saying they'd prefer fully digital, which was interesting. But then there's another study saying either fully digital or fully human, but not this human on a Zoom, which is interesting. Maybe it's Zoom fatigue. We've all got that, I guess.
Yeah, but probably on that note, I think that, you know, not all doctors are the same. Not all consumers or patients are the same. And I think we have to, in many ways, let our end customers self-select the channels that they want. I'm actually a firm believer in more of a hybrid model, that there are times that all of our customers want to engage with a human, right? But there are also times when a digital touch point can be far faster and provide certain benefits. So, for example, as a physician, the odds that I'm going to call in to a MedInfo line to ask a simple question about dosing, et cetera, things that, you know, I should know but may not know, I'm not going to do that, right? But I will use a virtual agent to respond to those queries, right? And so let's call these questions or interactions that sometimes make the user feel embarrassed or stigmatized or judged, right? And so it's really more about understanding what the customer use case. So for very simple things, really easy to grab, you know, and resolve these through conversational agents. And by the way, as these solutions mature, the complexity of what they can respond to is always increasing. But it's really important to understand then when do you hand these off, you know, to the human and allow the human to step in and provide that extra level of information and service.
So I suppose there gets, in some conversations, the conversational AI can basically handle the whole thing smoothly from end to finish. And in other cases, maybe there's something that's really just needs a human input on it if it's...
Yes, or there are times based on, so when you really understand what the question is from a customer, there are times, and adverse event would be a great example, when you are going to move it beyond the AI capability immediately. So there'll be certain intents that as soon as you understand what the customer is looking for, you may immediately move that to a human interaction. So it's up to the business side to determine what they want to do. What's critical, of course, is that the AI has to understand that entire portfolio of conversations that are coming into the system, right? And just as an example, we kind of let our clients know there could be up to 300 kind of core conversations that you could have with your customers. It's now up to you to triage and understand, create a policy model by which ones are answered by a rich conversation, which ones may be escalated to a human right away, which ones may go into an AE detection response solution. And sometimes, you know, you're simply just giving simple answers. Right? Mm-hmm. Not every AI needs to be a rich human-like experience. Sometimes you just want to confirm a number so that you can move on in your clinical day with patients in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that you know, we're focusing on the two areas that John and I work on, which is, I think, the front-end communication with the patient or the healthcare professional that John's team does really well, and the capture of, call it, negative data in real time that we do. I think the other part is we're all part of now a suite of technologies that operate in, call it, the telehealth or decentralized trial landscapes and all the rest of it. I think the only thing I would add here is that it's great to see that, because I think it means that the pool of patients and the access patients have to meaningful healthcare or meaningful answers to their questions is much better than ever was. The downside is that trial integrity is at risk. And I think everyone who's running trials now, whether they're pre or post approval, is trying hard to assure themselves and probably the regulators that those trials have integrity. And then the second part is obviously that people are playing with, you know, every single organization we talk to now says, well, you know, can you connect with wearables? And you go, yeah, okay. Well, what's the problem the wearable is trying to solve? You know, is it making the person's health better? Is it worrying them? Is it giving them diagnoses which are meaningless? You know, it's like the Apple Watch and the cardiac rhythm disturbances. I mean, it's another BS piece of technology, which, yes, it may evolve, but right now it's not at the point where it can be mainstream. So I think, you know, there's a piece around how do we augment what humans do well, which is, I think, really important, which is where the conversational AI and the capture of data in real time is really important. But that doesn't negate the human interaction that's needed. I think John is highlighting that. And I would say, you know, like a physical examination, the laying on of hands is still a fundamental, whether you're in trials or post-approval, whether that's because the person is having a problem with their medicines or they've got a fundamental problem with their disease. That laying on of hands or the human contact is really important. That contact can be initially done, you know, it can be triaged to a virtual human. So as John says, you can do it through a virtual assistant and ultimately flag it to a human. But at some point, there is a physical interaction that's needed. And I think we, just all of us who work in that digital space, need to be mindful of that, that at some point we hand off to a human that is physically going to see a patient. Now, that may not always happen in trials, but I think at some point people want to know, is there a real patient at the end of all this?
Yeah, that's a great point. And just to double click on that, I think it's about using humans to their highest value, right?
Yeah.
So to your point, I mean, if we can, you know, remove some of the busy work that a physician's doing during history capture, et cetera, you know, can we get high fidelity information that allows people to focus in very quickly? Even when you're moving things within a call center system, right? The information that's being provided in advance will allow humans to get much faster to where they need to get at the endpoint. So it's really about efficiency.
Yeah.
I think that all, you know, participants in the system are realizing that now.
Yeah. In fact, we talked about that before with Andrew, didn't we? About the adverse event call centers being overwhelmed.
Yeah, so exactly that. And I think there's two parts. One is the call centers are overwhelmed with busy work, but I think there's another part, which is the accuracy of data. So the more transcriptions, the more handoffs there are in terms of a patient being handed off to various people, whether it's a call center, you know, somebody working in a data processing hub, they're often, you know, they're not with the patient. And I think what always distresses me as a physician is when, yeah, I mean, let's get back to, you know, I can talk about an area. So drug safety, or call it medical coding of anything that occurs in trials or post-approval where analysis needs to be done on that. Companies tend to employ people to code that data. and structure the data because it's come in a mess. So they either use humans, they use AI, whatever else, to structure downstream. So they're not focusing on the upfront sensible capture of data in a structured way. They're focusing downstream to clean that up. Those people are completely dissociated from the patient. And I always say, so how can a person who's a data scientist sitting in, let's call it Philadelphia, or you know, in Eastern Europe or wherever, make an assessment of what that patient really was trying to say? They can't. And they say, well, we employ medical experts. Well, you may employ medical experts, but they're not with the patient. So they're making an interpretation. So I think one of the things I think both our organizations feel strongly about is, why not front end a lot of what we do and have that interaction as meaningfully as possible in as real time as possible with a patient or a consumer that enables them to give you that information or have that communication. And then ultimately people downstream can have got opportunities, whether it's because things are flagged to them or they've got data, which is actually a lot better than they would have received otherwise.
Interesting. And so the way a lot of things are done in pharma now, in the way it's, the incumbent processes are much more human-centered, what do you both think it will take to change that to becoming a more digital-first process?
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak to this from the conversational side, which is, I think one of the reasons why there's less friction is that when you build conversational solutions to engage your consumers, patients, physicians, whoever that may be, it's not that you're creating net new content, right? Creating content is a massive barrier. Mm-hmm. In this case, the content exists, whether it be on websites or other digital assets that you've created. You have content or responses that have come through call center, et cetera, et cetera. So really the challenge that we look at is, how do we conversationalize your existing assets and literally transform them into something that your customers want to engage with, right? So that's kind of the key thing, is that the barrier isn't about crafting and creating net new assets. In most cases, it's really about just changing it into a different interactive model, right? And so that's really, really important that we've seen. And so it's not like we're starting from scratch where, you know, we've got the football on the 75-yard line and now we're just making it far more meaningful and impactful for your customers, which is what they want. I mean, no one goes to their doctor's office to just receive a brochure, right? They go there to have a conversation. And so it's a similar model here, is, you know, and of course, you know, when you can start to move your customers away from just reading content and into a conversation, then you open up all the capabilities of what a conversation allows. And in many cases, and I'm sure Andrew is aware, you know, has experienced this many, many times, when a patient asks a question, that's just a lead into where you want to take them, right? In many cases, our customers don't know what they don't know. And so conversational experiences now allow us then to look at the next best action or the next best conversation. So when they ask A on the poll, what do we now push as the next 2, 3, 4 conversations? And by the way, because it is a conversational experience, maybe we can reach out and initiate a conversation with them on day 2 or day 4 or day 5, right? So it's this new capacity that really, though, is leveraging existing assets and content and insights.
I mean, one of the people I follow was looking at the whole digital landscape. I mean, beyond what we're describing, and I think he was looking at his career, and it sort of mirrored some of my experiences in the past. Back in the day when genomics became the latest hot thing, like digital is today, you know, everyone believed that you could identify the right patient, you know, basically the right drug for the right patient at the right time was the mantra. You know, you'd know their genetic profile, you'd know which drug was going to work in them, you'd know their side effect, who was going to get side effects. Well, surprisingly, we're maybe just about scraping the surface in some areas at the moment, and genomics is just coming into more mainstream, given the cost of the technology has come down dramatically. So you can sequence a person's genome for about $1,000, whereas, you know, in the past it was probably $1 million. So it's taken a long time, and I think I think we also need to be mindful. Yes, digital tools, we can deploy many digital tools today, which I think, as John has described, is how do we make that interaction much more meaningful today. There are other digital tools which I think require a bit more thought. And I think lumping everything digital into the same box is not right, because I think they're tools that need to be validated. You know, it's a bit like John was saying, you know, we've got medical content here which is readily accessible. So let's use that. The tools we have for conversation are there. Some of the other tools on the periphery, I don't think are ready for mainstream. And we need to be upfront on that and say, okay, we can try them. But some of that is trial and error, and we need to work through that. So I'm a passionate believer in making is creating opportunities to connect with patients, so that the data that they can or they can share experiences and data in a very simple, meaningful way that can then be used for robust analysis downstream. Because only then, once we've got that data downstream, can we continually assess how those products are working across a population. They won't work the same way in all of us. So we can begin to tease apart what are the intrinsic and extrinsic factors influencing responses to the medicines that they're taking, and influence that in a positive way. The alternative, which is I think where pharma focuses at the moment, is, well, I'm not going to bother trying to get really great data at the front end and really connect with the patients or the doctors who are managing those patients at the front end. What I'm going to do is put a massive effort into structuring the junk that's coming in the middle. I'm going to put middleware in that's going to structure that junk, and then hopefully my analytic teams will be able to make sense of the junk that I've structured. I mean, I think however many times science has tried that approach, it tends not to work. So I'm a firm believer in, yes, you know, let's do the best we can of creating the best possible and most and highest value data flow from patients, recognizing not every patient can communicate everything digitally, but we can provide them assistance, whether that's through an AI assistant or a human assistant, that they have the same digital tools at their disposal that enable that data to flow seamlessly to people at the back end, who are then going to make meaningful assessments of what that data is telling us about the way the products are working or causing adverse issues with those patients.
No, I totally agree. And I've seen pharma companies spend so much money just getting all their data into data lakes and cleaning and scrubbing, but a lot of that data is old and out of date and actually completely useless and pointless, yeah, doing anything too. So, and particularly now with the way the world has changed in the last year, you know, a lot is different. You want up-to-date data that's right there. So how do you both see how pharma can balance driving this change to become digital first, but setting practically achievable goals? You know, how can they balance those two things?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I've definitely seen over the last year, 2 years with conversational AI is taking a much more strategic approach, as I mentioned earlier, right? So it's a new capability. And so what we see is that each business unit can use conversational AI in a different way, right? I mean, it's a new capability that is relevant across the enterprise. And so what I think we're seeing is just a very structured approach. And typically you'll find that they'll look initially at areas where there's great cost savings, right? Cost saving is a critical and determinant in terms of investment. And so you see a lot of this automation of call center where you have expensive humans coming in. And then, you know, over the last, you know, year, 6 months, we're seeing a big movement towards more of the commercial side of the business, right? And how do we, you know, create virtual sales force solutions? How do we take our e-details, all of the kind of commercial things, the brand websites that they've been building, how do they translate those from being kind of the push model to much more of a pull experience that's conversational? And then, of course, now you see this moving downstream into clinical trials, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things that we've seen is this kind of ability for them very quickly to get in and do POCs. Mm. And what do they do in a POC? What are the new capability? Well, the first thing they test out is, can it actually work? Mm. Right? Can AI actually understand what someone is writing to you or speaking to you, and then understand, you know, how do you deliver a conversation to them? So that's step one, right? It's the AI NLU challenge that you face, which is fairly significant in healthcare, where the lexicon that we use is different than other verticals, right? Step one is done. Then two, you kind of figure out whether or not your customers will actually find this experience to be valuable and positive, right? And so what happens, I think, in pharma, they've done a great job, is you can get over those very quickly. And, you know, the world is to a point now where you can do a great job at those two, or certainly we've been able to achieve that. And then it's really about understanding about how do you apply it then across the enterprise? Where does this new capability work across, you know, Med Affairs? Does it work across commercial? Where does it work in all these areas? And then start to test them out for each one, right? Not every brand will use conversational AI in the same way, right? Obviously, mature brands, a totally different use case. They can all use it, but the use case and the investment is completely different, right? So I think we've just been, you know, really, you know, positive in the way that's being approached, not from an ad hoc, you know, siloed approach. And one of the key things, I think, is because conversational AI is more of a platform play, there's a recognition quickly that this is going to be something that can be applied across the entire enterprise, right? And so it's not just being done quickly by silo, that they realize that data is ultimately that what powers this, taxonomies power this, and every pharmaceutical company needs to go in and establish that as a foundation and then figure out exactly how do they invest across each one of the business units.
Yeah, I would concur with what John's saying. I mean, what we found is successful is where companies try to do meaningful assessments of a specific piece of work. So those that are, you know, in the awful word of boiling the ocean of, you know, somebody wants a fully fledged solution on day one that does everything, it's just unrealistic. I think most companies that succeed take a sensible stepwise approach and say, well, we've thought this through, we know what our end goal is, and we don't quite know how we're going to get there, but you look like the company or the partners with whom we can work to get there. So let's use an iterative approach. Let's start with something we can see you can actually do. So that's number one, is, you know, the amount of smoke and mirrors that occurs in client demos is quite extraordinary. So you can say, oh, right, you've actually demonstrated something that works and is live and is actually in use. Great. Right. Why don't we try and test that out within a specific part of our portfolio, a specific region, a specific language? Once we've got confidence that that's moving ahead, and actually the team then have a better understanding of what the business requirements are, we can move to the next level. And that usually works really well.
Interesting. Have you seen examples of companies that try and do everything, bite off more than they can chew, and then...
Yeah, I mean, we all have. I mean, companies do, and sometimes it's not done for bad intent. It's really done often because there's an unrealistic view of what is possible, and often that's driven by organizations that they've seen or talked to who've come in and said, you know what, you can have the earth, the moon, and the stars, and the car, not only can the car drive along and it can go through the city and it goes up hills, but, you know, a car can fly. And, you know, and you go, well, yeah, and yes, it can, but nobody's shown it could, you know, it's possible. And I think I think where we've seen companies trip up is where they come in with a set of requirements which go, well, you know, how fast can the car go? And does it have air conditioning? You know, does it have 20-inch wheels? Does it have a V8 engine, or does it have an electric engine? Does it have wing? You know, does it have, you know, flip up? Does it have auto this and auto that? And you go, well, what are you trying to use the car for? You know, is your problem to go around the city by yourself because you want to commute into the city, or are you carting the family on a camp trip, or are you a farmer who has to cart large amounts of hay to their cattle at the weekend, you know, during the week? And they go, oh, right, we hadn't thought through what our business use case, we just want to know what the car can do. Well, yeah, well, then you're not going to get a product that actually meets your requirements.
That's the biggest issue I see all the time with pharma is, you know, I will go to a company and they'll say, we want AI, and I'll say, okay, what do you want it for? We don't know. Can you find the use case? And I see that a lot. And I also see it being led by tech, where they buy the technology, but they don't. I've had that time and time again where I've gone to a company and said, we've bought Hadoop. And I go, okay, great. Why? I don't know. Can you find out what we should do with it? And that's, I always awesome. Keep saying exactly what you just said. You know, start with your business problem or objective, and yeah, then figure out where, you know, what's going to be the right solution for that. But yeah, I see the cart before the horse so often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would, if I were to double click on that, I would simply say that, you know, some of the challenges we sometimes see is that some of our clients will want to move too quickly into AI, so moving very quickly to voice or digital human solutions without taking the initial step, which is, you know, creating the foundational kind of text experience. There's so much that gets learned in that first foundational build, not only in setting up taxonomies and data structure, et cetera, but it's super sexy to go to voice. It's super sexy to go to digital. And those are great, absolutely amazing opportunities for pharma specifically, right? Because, you know, pharma lives in a world where human facial expression and voice experiences are very, very important, but they just need to come at the right sequence. I would say that that's key. But I would also say that, you know, as a new capability, conversational AI is something that every part of the enterprise, if you show it to them and explain to them, will say, oh, I have a use case for that. Why? Because every brand, every part of a business wants to have on demand, you know, human-like interactions with their customers, right? The question, of course, is which ones do you do first, right? Because there are so many, you know, challenges in the business that can be overcome, but it's not, you know, it's really about defining what is the first use case, the first experience. And as I said, that one shouldn't be predicated on a pure business ROI, because sometimes the use case isn't that powerful. But what you're proving out is the ability to set the foundation, to set up your taxonomies, your NLU, right, your machine learning, all the things that are critical to the ultimate success as you deploy across the enterprise. So that's super important. And by the way, just to double click on that, you know, we've had one of our clients in the last 6 months, you know, instead of actually building something up front, they actually said, let's go and look at this from a more strategic approach. Let's look across all the different use cases. And as an enterprise, let's put together a roadmap for what we're going to actually do in Horizon 1, in Horizon 2, in Horizon 3, across all business units, so that we're actually making all the investments in a very smart way, that we're not racing ahead to something, a channel like voice, like a digital human too early, that we're applying the right solutions to the right business units and, you know, making the right investments at the right point. And of course, making the investments that are actually appropriate. So as I said, conversational AI is founded on having a great, you know, enterprise SaaS platform that once you design and build it can roll out for every brand, every customer group, in every market, in every language. Right? That's the massive power around conversational AI, right? Conversations are consistent in generality, or, you know, in 90% coverage overlap in every market. Mm. And so it's really important that you set that foundation early on, that this is where we're going to go as a business, right? We'll want to be able to create conversations that we can use, you know, in all markets. We want to have the capability of doing multi-language. All these things are just foundational.
Yeah, and I think we see language as one of the key barriers. So companies go, well, you know, can you do Japanese? And we can do multi-language, and we do multi-language. I think once we get into AI and multi-language, it's a real challenge. And we've seen this over and over again, is most AI engines at the moment don't do well outside of the English language. And you know, Japanese is obviously a key language for pharma. And that's one of the more challenging for AI components. So I think a phased approach generally works well, because you can then address some of the glitches early on and move through that, and then go to your next set of priorities. Because otherwise people go, well, can you do any language? You can do any language, but why do you need to? Yeah, and actually, you know, there's a law of diminishing returns in terms of some of the markets at the moment still have relatively, you know, there's still relatively low penetration. So actually having every language is not relevant.
But Andrew, as you know, Japan is a country with high digital adoption, right?
I know.
And so one of the challenges, one of the projects we worked on in the last year was a project that started in Japan.
Right.
And so we had to come in and, you know, pitch against all the local market vendors,
wow,
telcos, and won the business. And we were told, and it's going to be really tough, right? And it was a good challenge, but when the project launched, we exceeded all expectations. So I would say that if, you know, with the right time in the investment, you can get there, you know, within a 3 to 6 month period of time. Now, the really positive story coming out of that was, you know, yes, we delivered in Japan. Now that same solution is being launched into other markets, into North America and into Europe, right? And so now you start to see that massive economy of scale, but obviously had to overcome a big hurdle early on, which is, and it's not the translation, right? It's a lot of it's just the localization, understanding the cultural nuances, right? personas are different in different markets, right? Business strategy completely different. The audience is different, right? I mean, sales rep has a different connotation in Japan than it does in other markets, right? And so, you know, being highly respectful of all of the different nuances for every market is really important. But once achieved, then allows to that scale to go very quickly.
I remember in projects where we've done natural language processing in other languages, the three languages that took the computational linguists the most time were Japanese, Chinese, and Russian. The other ones were, you know, they could get their taxonomies and everything done in a month, but those ones took about 3 months. They were much more challenging for all of that.
But remember, 3 months, not that long if you're thinking about a go forward, you know, capability. And fundamentally, you know, I mean, you brought up a great point is, I think every pharma company is going to be very deep into these new technologies. And so the sooner you start, you know, you have to make these initial
steps. The sooner those 3 months is over.
Yeah, to get to maturity, you have to make that initial step. And I think that what's important is taking the right initial step.
That's good. Good advice. The roadmap and the right step to start with and the use case are the three takeaways I'm getting here. Thank you so much for a really interesting session. I really enjoyed hearing both your views on these and always do every time I've spoken to both of you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.